We have returned. It is the very latest edition of We've Seen That. I'm TJ Reeves. I am based in the Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater area. My colleague, my pal, my partner is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He is the famous Jay, Jay Betzel. Good to be back with you, partner.
Good to talk to you, TJ. How are things going?
Well, at the time you and I are talking, we're in the midst of the NFL season, and I have come back from a long, and let me emphasize one more time, long weekend that includes going all the way from Florida out to the Arizona desert only to watch my Buccaneers be beaten badly and then fly all the way back. But groggy, sleep-deprived, properly caffeinated now, I was not going to miss the opportunity to talk with you about one of our favorite movies on We've Seen That, at least in the comedy genre, and something from the 1980s. It is a movie that I think we're going to have a lot of fun with, you and me. I think a lot of the people that are listening to our shows here have seen this, have seen the replays of this, and are going to engage big time, because whenever you say the name Eddie Murphy, whenever you say the name hit action comedy, like what this movie is, I think people are going to gravitate to it, at least people that are our age anyway, right?
Are you talking about Another 48 Hours?
I'm not talking about Another 48 Hours, although that could be a future We've Seen That. I'm talking instead about, yes, Beverly Hills Cop 2. Let's get in the mood. Let's get in the spirit.
All of you eat the floor now.
Yeah. Axel Foley is back.
Who is he?
I'd say he's a cop.
This is a Detroit badge. What the hell are you doing in Beverly Hills?
I'm going deep undercover.
Back where he doesn't belong.
Excuse me, we're the owners of this house.
They're in Hawaii for a week while the construction's happening.
I'm Axel Foley, Beverly Hills Building Inspector.
You stole in this house.
How do you steal a house? It's my uncle's house.
Reunited with all his old buddies.
What the hell's going on here? Who the hell are you?
I'm Johnny Wishbone, psychic extraordinaire. If you need me, just think Johnny Wishbone and I come running. Lots and biddle. It's like kibbles and bits, but different.
Oh, this is a big mistake, a big mistake.
Would you lighten up and take some risk?
This is definitely breaking the law.
So how long would it take to shave those legs anyway?
I suppose you're trying to be charming.
Actually, I'm just offering my grooming services.
Get out of here, you degenerate! I want you out of here!
Is this a black thing?
Hey! Tell you alone, you're gonna break it!
I need authorization.
Authorize!
Are we having a problem here?
You have to! Axel Foley! And this is Max. And Max kills cops for a living!
Eddie Murphy, Beverly Hills Cop 2, The Heat's back on.
All right, so hopefully everybody's hyped up. That's the actual, this is the first time we tried that. That is the actual movie trailer from the 1987, at the time we're talking, the 30th anniversary of Beverly Hills Cop 2, the release of Beverly Hills Cop 2 from Paramount Pictures. Famous Jay, you have all the vital stats on Beverly Hills Cop 2, after I kind of gave a little tip there on it's the 30th anniversary. Give me more.
Oh, my gosh. This was such a big deal back when it came out in 1987. Its opening weekend, it made $26,348,000 for it to be the number one weekend of the year, the biggest opening weekend of 1987. These days, that would be a disappointment for most movies. But back in 1987, $26 million and change. It was the number one movie of the week. It was released on May 20th, 1987. As far as the, let's see, the Beverly Hills Cop series. It was the second ranked on the box office. The original Beverly Hills Cop, which came out in 1984, made $234 million. It was number one of the year. It beat Indiana Jones, The Temple of Doom, and Ghostbusters to be the number one movie of 1984. Beverly Hills Cop 2, obviously, was a big event movie. It was one of the most anticipated movies of the year. It made $153 million. Beverly Hills Cop 3, not so much. It came out in 1994. Grossed $42 million total.
Okay,
we'll get into that a little later.
Yeah, we'll get into that definitely later. Now, you mentioned the original, and you and I know so many different factoids and nuggets for those that are familiar with our shows and with we've seen that. And I love this trivia question because you can get most people on this without looking, because you would go down a mental Rolodex of people that might have played Axel Foley, the character, the lead, the cop from Detroit in Beverly Hills Cop, the original, instead of Eddie Murphy. But most people would not get the person that the producers and the studio actually wanted without looking. So without looking, Jay Betzel, you know the answer, right, on who they originally wanted to play Axel Foley way back when in the 1984 hit movie. You know that, or you don't know that?
That would be Sylvester Stallone.
They wanted Rocky. They wanted Rambo. They wanted Stallone to be Axel Foley. That movie, I have said for four decades now, because we're four decades later, would have bombed with a capital B, would it have not? Had Sylvester Stallone have been the lead?
Top movie of the year. Eddie Murphy had only been in, I believe, two or three movies before this. Of course, people knew him from Saturday Night Live. He debuted in 48 Hours, then Trading Places. And I believe Best Defense was before Beverly Hills Cop. It might have been after. Either way, we're talking about a guy who's in his third or fourth movie.
And they
handed him the keys to this, and it ended up being huge. And I know, like, kind of the rundown of our show, we're going to talk about some fun facts and all that before we wrap it up later. But since you brought up Sylvester Stallone, there's a fun little side note to this. Basically, he wanted the Beverly Hills Cop, the original one, to be a serious, gritty action movie, not the kind of fun action comedy that it was. And basically, he kind of took what he wanted Beverly Hills Cop to be and turned it into Cobra.
Well,
and Cobra,
right.
And there's a Cobra poster in Judge Reinhold's room in Beverly Hills Cop 2. So it all kind of comes back.
And there's
around.
Other reasons for that, because we're going to get to that with the cast, etc. There's other reasons as to why that's there as well in the movie. But and he also, Stallone, while we digress on that, he ended up making the movie Tango and Cash with Kurt Russell in the late 80s, early 90s. Well, that's probably a future. We've seen that when we diagnose exactly when and what the anniversary is and how it did. And that's more along the lines of Beverly Hills Cop. It's an action drama comedy where there's a lot of humor at different points of the movie. And then there's a lot of serious blow 'em up in the movie. I think a few years later, that's a good 6, 7, 8 years later, that's the kind of Beverly Hills Cop you would have seen. But it would not have worked. With Stallone there instead of Eddie Murphy. Instead, it made Eddie Murphy a worldwide star beyond just Saturday Night Live when he made the first one, and they were obviously so charged up about it that it led them to make a sequel. I don't know that they were always intending to have a Beverly Hills Cop 2, but like so many movies, when it does so well, speaking of Stallone, it's like when Stallone wrote Rocky and had such massive success, and it won Best Picture, and he was Best Director and starred in it, and was nominated for Best Actor, Best Musical Score. They came to him almost immediately and said, "Congratulations! This is unbelievable. You've done something truly unreal as an individual that you've wrote, directed, and starred in this, and gotten all this Academy acclaim. Now go write the sequel. Now go get us a second one so we can make one. It's kind of the same thing.
Where there says there's no rematch. Let's go ahead and just make believe like that didn't happen.
Right, exactly. Because he intended to move on to the next thing. The studio went, no, this is so good. We need another one. We need Rocky 2. It's kind of the same thing with Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Beverly Hills Cop gave us, if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have like the Lethal Weapons and the Die Hard.
Right.
All these action movies that have one-liners and all that. They basically came from 48 Hours in Beverly Hills Cop.
Much less would we have had two of them or three of them or four of them, because they all followed the same pattern. They all followed the same essentially game plan, which is have a successful first one and then make sure that you have enough ammo, enough storyline, and develop the characters enough, bring some of the actors, if not the star actors, back, and have the next one ready to go. And 3 years later,
And you know what you do then, TJ?
Yeah.
You go to the bank.
Yeah, well, yeah, a bunch. And they're still going to the bank years later, as we've talked about before, on We've Seen That. All right, so give me the vital stats here on the cast. and the plot here to the original, because I would think most everyone is familiar with this, but if you're not familiar with this, the story, Jay, is a Detroit police detective who is drawn to Los Angeles and Beverly Hills because of the murder of one of his friends. So pick it up on that point.
Right. In the original one, his friend Michael Tandino basically gets executed in Axel's apartment. So Axel gets some vacation time that his friendly Inspector Todd gives him. So he goes out to Beverly Hills to basically investigate the Michael Tandino murder. Fast forward to part two. He's supposed to go out to Beverly Hills and have a fishing trip with his buddies, who were Taggart, Rosewood, and Andrew Bogomil. And basically he's working on a credit card bust, and Bogomil's working on the alphabet crimes, and Bogomil gets shot down in broad daylight. And so now Axel needs to come back out to Beverly Hills, you know, because he's loyal to the guy that basically saved his career at the end of Beverly Hills Cop 1. He was going to get fired because Inspector Todd had told him not to go out there and investigate that murder, and he did. So Bogomil had called and basically vouched for what a great job he did. So he feels loyal to Bogomil. So he goes back out to Beverly Hills to visit Taggart and Rosewood and do a little investigating on Bogomil's. He actually got shot. He's in the hospital. He did not get murdered, but he's basically in critical condition when he arrives in L.A.
Okay, so we got so much to talk about with what you just laid out there, because remember, in the original, as an outsider, probably the biggest resistance to him trying to investigate and solve his friend's murder is who? The lieutenant, Bogomil. And the irony is, with Bogomil trying to get rid of him, Bogomil finally realizes he's onto something, and the character Victor Maitland, the evil art-dealing, drug-dealing, murdering, organized crime member, is behind Tandino's murder and is involved in Beverly Hills and the criminal activity. So what ends up happening is they have the last scene kind of shootout that you're culminating with, where Axel's not only shooting Maitland, but Maitland now has a chance to kill Axel Foley in the first one. And who saves his life? Who shoots Bogomil. Him? Bogomil, the captain. So that's what sets everything into motion for the second one, is they have now become friends. They have now become more than just colleagues. He saved Axel's life, Jay, at the end of the first one.
Yeah, and then, you know, when Axel's actually trying to do his credit card bust, and he's got the guy he's got set up, he's bringing the blank American Express cards, and the guy that he brings with him is the guy from the first one who was on the truckload of cigarettes. It was in the opening credits of the original Beverly Hills Cop. And so he ends up not making the bust. But while he's there, because, of course, the crooks are late, while he's there, he sees on TV about Bogomil getting gunned down in broad daylight. So he calls the hospital, finds out what's going on. That's when he gets his secret undercover partner, Jeffrey Friedman, to drive around in his Ferrari for the purpose of his undercover in Detroit so that he can sneak out.
Well, yeah,
to L.A. and be a California hero.
We got to get him out to Beverly Hills somehow, some way.
And, you know, he's got to make sure that Inspector Todd doesn't know he's gone, because he's not getting vacation time like in the first one. He needs to go out there on his own.
Yeah, very much so. Okay, so, again, it's intertwined because the actors, a lot of the same actors are there, as you mentioned, for the cast, and some of those same characters are also there. So, but they're going to introduce new villains. There's got to be a new organized crime villain in this case. There's going to be a new female villain in this case, which was something different for Beverly Hills Cop 2. So you ready to get into that here on We've Seen That?
Absolutely. Do tell. I want to hear your take on Carla Fry.
Okay, so first of all, they cast Jürgen Prochnow, if I said that. How do you say that name?
Jürgen Prochnow.
Prochnow as the villain, Maxwell Dent. And Prochnow, I never could figure out, is he supposed to be German? Is he supposed to be like Eastern European? Do we really know what he's supposed to be? I don't know.
I want to say, at one point, you know, when they, because remember, he picked his pocket and they looked him up on the computer, and he had a visa that was expiring. He was going to Costa Rica, and he'd been like some
right
Honduran attaché,
East
or something.
German,
so,
East
yeah.
German, something like that,
right.
Along the lines. So anyway, but he's firmly in Beverly Hills, and he is pulling robberies of different places. And setting it all up to make a huge arms deal at the end. And of course, this is the 1980s when the arms deals were going on, documented fact, under the Reagan administration, where in South America the arms deals were being littered every which direction. So the screenwriters, the filmmakers, they decided to play on that and have the Dent character be part of that. And the female lead playing Carla Fry is Brigitte Nielsen, who was obviously a prominent actress in the late 1980s and a little bit in the 90s.
Cool. And at this time, she was married to Sylvester Stallone.
There you go. Most known for being the wife of Ivan Drago in Rocky IV, but at the same time cast for that role because she was intimate with Stallone and later married, I guess, for a little while to Stallone. And so off of her role in Rocky and a couple of other things, including Cobra, like you mentioned, she ends up getting cast as the female villain, Carla Fry. And she's actually in the opening scene. She's in the opening scene of the movie, right, doing the jewelry shopping and robbing the jewelry store in Beverly Hills with everybody with the guns and stealing all the jewelry, right?
Right, and she looks super hot at the very beginning. She gets out of the car. You know, the valet comes to open the door because, you know, the jewelry store is here in Fort Worth where I'm from. You park your car and you just walk in. And apparently in Beverly Hills, they have doormen like they do at a hotel. And the store's name was Adriano's, I believe.
I believe you got it right.
She gets out there.
If I'm correct, that's A in the alphabet crime. So keep going.
Yes. And let's kind of throw a little fun gossip into it. I was doing some research for this very important show we do. And People Magazine has that Brigitte Nielsen and the director of this film, Tony Scott, had an affair, and that led to her divorce from Sylvester Stallone.
Really?
Which was in July of 1987.
Wow.
So throw that little fun fact in. That might have been why she looked so hot in this movie. Her director locked him up to make sure he hit her good side.
Well, either that or she was guaranteeing the role. There's different angles and different takes that you can have on that. That is something I did not know. I'm like Johnny Carson. Of course, you make Johnny Carson references on We've Seen That, and no one knows under the age of 30 what we're talking about, but that is something I did not know. So, so Brigitte Nielsen makes her appearance at the very beginning of this movie, and she's one of the main characters, as one of the main villains, as they're trying to solve the alphabet crimes. And as it turns out, she ends up being the one blowing away Andrew Bogomil as the B crime. Remember, she's on the side of the road with the car broken down in Beverly Hills. She's got the wig on. He pulls up to help her out, which is kind of suspicious to begin with. Sees her standing
there. Hang on one sec. But let me digress for a second. First off, he gets suspended by new Chief Lutz, who's
right.
Basically fired all of the police officers from Beverly Hills other than Taggart, Rosewood, and Bogomil. He gets suspended because as part of the alphabet investigation, Rosewood called the supervisor of the FBI.
That's right. His friend.
And so Bogomil
trying to help
them
solve
suspended.
The crime. Right, right, right.
Yeah, he gets suspended by Chief Lutz, and so he's leaving. So he didn't have a real good day. He got suspended, and then he tries to be nice to this really hot lady in a Mercedes who's pulled over, and she ends up shooting him.
He's doing his public duty, protect and serve,
he's
go help
nice
the public.
Guy.
We see officers do this all the time, troopers, Texas Rangers out where you are, Mounties in Canada, whatever. You know, they come by on car, by boat for the Coast Guard, by horse in Canada, and they try to help. Damsels in distress, that's what he's trying to do. He ends up getting shot for his
trouble. Yeah, he's looking at her engine, and she gives him the B envelope.
She puts the B envelope on him after she shoots him.
So what do you make of this, Andrew?
Yes, and ends up shooting him. So we know right away that Carla Fry is not to be messed with. As you mentioned, that sets the movie into motion because that's now the reason for Foley to go back to Beverly Hills and try to help solve the alphabet crimes and find out who tried to kill and seriously wounded Captain Andy Bogomil. So that puts the movie into motion. So,
plot-wise, can we agree that this is kind of a glorified remake of the first one? As we've kind of intertwined both stories, I just want to let everybody know that there's a lot of things that are very in common with these two.
Well, right.
They kind of follow that if it ain't broke, don't fix it model.
Well, yeah, because they had so much success. What was it again? $200 million on the first Beverly Hills?
$234 million in the U.S. alone.
They had 234 million reasons to follow the same kind of storyline and cookie cutter format, but the way that worked. I mean, when you contemplate that we're now talking 30 years later, that movie is easily double in today's time, you're talking about a $500 million. Dollar action comedy where you didn't have to have hundreds of millions of dollars in special effects and computers and animators and all the different things that you have to use. So,
and you know why? Because Eddie Murphy was about the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
You know, he made it an event movie by him being in it. That was just a big deal. So he arrives in Beverly Hills, and the first one, remember, he conned his way into basically staying at the Regent Beverly Wilshire by saying that he was with Rolling Stone magazine. And this one, he's driving around in Beverly Hills and sees a construction crew working on the house, and tell me how that works out.
Well, he ends up being able to convince the construction crew that he's the inspector, that they've got the wrong house plans, to get them to leave, and now he has a house to stay in. And of
remember,
course,
it's not supposed to have any right angles.
Right, and this house is supposed to be round as a donut. I don't know why these people do that. It goes, it's supposed to be round as a donut. So anyway, later on, obviously, in the plot line, when Taggart and Rosewood show up, they immediately, Taggart is automatically suspicious because he knows
so you stole his house.
You stole this house, and of course, Axel's line back to him is, "How the F do I steal a house?" You
know, it's my uncle's house.
Yes, it's my uncle's house, and so that's how he has the house. But anyway,
back to that scene for just a second. Taggart basically tells him, "I want you out of this pool and out of this house in 7 minutes. You're still a police officer. You're going to get us all in trouble." And he says, he's like, "I love it when you talk dirty." And he's watching Wheel of Fortune, obviously, because Vanna White's on TV. And if you watch really closely, Taggart has his sunglasses on when he's yelling at him. And then when it cuts back to him, right before he falls in the pool, he does not have his sunglasses on. So a little goof there if you're paying attention.
Because you're a savant like I am, you pay attention to these things. I wonder, though, they probably only did the one take where he actually falls in the pool. Do you think they did that more than one time where John Ashton, the actor playing Taggart, actually went in the pool? Or do you think they made him go in the pool multiple times?
That's a good one, you know, and people, the more people listen to this show of ours, we've seen that, then people are going to realize I absolutely love the late Tony Scott, the director of this movie, and Top Gun, Days of Thunder, many others. And, you know, I think that he probably had him do multiple takes of the original part, but I'm with you. He probably had him do one take, and they just put the two together.
Yeah, maybe so. And then again, you know, maybe he had him go in the pool two or three times. That's not beyond the realm. On that. So again, there's a lot of different nuances here in this movie. The plot line does compare to the first one, and they keep that storyline rolling into the second one, that he's trying to solve the alphabet crimes here with the two guys that helped him inadvertently, I guess.
By virtue of Taggart going into the water, remember, he has to change clothes.
Right.
And so they, you know, just like they did in the first one, they have to go visit the strip club. Because that's, you know, in the first one, Eddie Murphy went because he's a fun guy. That's what he likes to do. In this one, he goes because he saw in Boga Mills' file the ad for 385 North.
That's right.
So he has to go check this club
out.
To
find
out
what it is.
And when he shows up, he tells the guy at the door that Taggart is former President Gerald Ford.
But he looks different with all the makeup on TV.
Exactly.
Former President
right.
Ford. And then everybody's clapping for former President Ford when he comes in to sit down. And
the fact they look nothing alike.
Yes, you know. That's true, other than the fact that they're white guys in California with bad clothes on. And
but it
balding.
Also does introduce the character Nick Thamopoulos, who is the arms dealer, who is going to buy or sell the guns to Maxwell Dent. Because remember, Eddie Murphy's at the bar and he orders the $7 Coke.
Right, but that's Paul Guilfoyle, who we would later see on a lot of different shows, including CSI. He's in the great movie The Negotiator with Samuel L. Jackson. But Thamopoulos never says anything in the movie. We see him in the club. He's seen but not heard, Jay, on Beverly Hills Cop 2, where Guilfoyle is standing there with the ladies as the arms dealer. It's his club. He doesn't say anything. And if I'm correct, the only other time we see him is at the very, very end of the movie when he gets arrested.
We also see him at the Playboy Mansion.
Ah, yes.
But again, he doesn't. Eddie Murphy am I correct? Max he doesn't. And Thamopoulos to Hugh Hefner. He's into guns and drugs.
Yes. He's into guns and drugs, that kind of stuff. But he doesn't say anything. Am I confirmed on that? Guilfoyle doesn't have a speaking part in this. Never says even hello.
The only time I remember him saying anything is, which was I thought was really odd. It stood out to me. Is when Eddie Murphy at the very end they are making the arms deal. They're leaving the Empyrean Fields where Chief Lutz is telling the press that they've solved the alphabet bandits or the alphabet crimes and guarantees there will not be an F crime. And Eddie Murphy follows the dirt over to dense oil fields where the horses are grazing and sees all the trucks. And then he's peeking in. And Thamopoulos basically tells Dent, "I'm going to need your signature here," which is crazy that they're making this illegal deal and he wants him to sign something.
That's the only, that's the only line.
That's the only time I remember him speaking.
My point is that in these movies and in the Screen Actors Guild and all these deals with commercials and TV shows and movies, you get paid differently if you actually say something. So I'm impressed as we go back and forth. I mean, you impress me, I impress you. You knew that he had a speaking part. So Guilfoyle obviously got a little more money because he actually said something that they used in the movie. even though the line is, I need your signature here.
It was very strange, and they may have even thrown that in for his benefit. Who knows?
Right. Maybe to give him a little something on that. Okay, so anyway, we've laid out the plot here and how it unfolds with the alphabet crimes and trying to solve it and figure out who's behind. I mean, we know ultimately that Dent is behind the crimes and the clues, and the as the plot line goes, they're trying to get away with it, trying to do the arms deal, and trying to frame one of the henchmen, Charles Kane, who is played by the actor Dean Stockwell. Stockwell was famous for another reason in the late 80s and the early 90s in terms of acting. You want to go ahead and lay that out there, that bit of truth? You know that about Dean Stockwell, by the way?
I knew Dean Stockwell from Quantum Leap.
There you go. After this movie, he became huge with Scott Bakula, and Quantum Leap was on TV forever. So are we seeing that, fans that are our age, that will remember Quantum Leap? So Stockwell became more popular and prominent because of that in the movie. But he's framed as Chip Kane, Charles Kane, as essentially the fall guy in this. And it, as it turns out, when they're robbing Imperium Fields, the horse racing track, she ends up killing a member of her own crew, and kills a couple of other guys from her own crew
Carla Fry, yeah, who is obviously the biggest, baddest of all the people in this movie. She basically just smiles and says, goodbye, Mr. Kane.
Mm. Well, remember when, I love when Axel goes to try to find what happened from the Adrianus robbery at the beginning, and goes to the gun club, and has ended up back at the gun club looking into the ammunition and the bullets and how they could have gotten there, and tracing it back to the gun club. He ends up meeting Carla Fry. And
Let's not forget he stole evidence from the Beverly
Well,
Hills
right.
Police.
But he only, in his words, I only took one of them. There's a whole bunch of them.
There's a whole bunch.
I'm sure that Eddie Murphy came up with it. It could not have been in the script, where he says, Charles Bronson's a close personal friend of the family. Charles Bronson gave me this for Christmas. That is a phenomenal, phenomenal off. That can't be in the script.
The 308 rifles.
Right, right.
Cut to fit a 44.
So he's trying to find out more information about it, and he ends up meeting Carla Fry. She's trying to occupy him while they look at him and figure out who he is. They figure out that Axel's a cop, blah blah blah. But the interesting thing is, he comes back out and is telling Judge Reinhold and John Ashton, Rosewood and Taggart, that he's got the connection. There's something going on, because there's a 6-foot blonde woman like the robbery. And of course, John Ashton has the famous line back to him about 6-foot blonde women.
They grow on trees in California.
Yeah, it's not like this is
Judge
Detroit.
Reinhold says they're everywhere.
He's right. They're everywhere. It's not Detroit.
There's the part inside the gun club after he's talked to Russ Fielding, and she's called him back and, you know, basically confirmed that that's one of their guns, and he's traced it back. And she's out there kind of occupying his time. She's kind of leaned over in the counter like the For Your Eyes Only James Bond poster. And she's shooting, and he basically, being Eddie Murphy, says,
what
does
he ask her?
Shave those legs anyway.
Yes. And she goes, I'm sure you're trying to be charming, right? And what does he say?
He says, I'm offering my grooming service.
Exactly. Good line again. Again, probably an Eddie Murphy ad lib on that. He probably wrote that exchange back and forth. So in any event, that sets all of this into motion as to how they're going to figure it out in terms of the plot. We learn more about Billy Rosewood, though, in this plot. And what do we learn about what Rosewood has developed into after Axel in Beverly Hills Cop has basically empowered him to kind of be a vigilante or rogue officer? What have we learned about Rosewood as it develops in Beverly Hills Cop 2 in terms of his mindset, his gun collection, etc.?
Well, we know he has a pet turtle. We know he has a Rambo poster and a Cobra poster in his apartment, which he likes to have as a
tranquil
environment.
And he has a whole bunch of...
And he loves to buy guns.
He has a whole bunch of big-time arsenal guns. And, of course, they keep using the line throughout the movie of, Billy,
we gotta talk.
We gotta talk. Seriously, we gotta talk. Because of all the guns and all the stuff. This sets everything into motion as to how they're going to go after Dent and Fry and the bad guys and the caper. And of course, as you mentioned, you've got the evil chief of police, Chief Lutz, who's working against Bogomil and Rosewood and Taggart. And, we've got Ted Egan, the mayor of Beverly Hills, who's been called in here to try to solve this with these crimes going on. They don't want to believe the outlaw rogue cops here that are trying to solve the case on their own. Right. That's why the movie works.
Right. We've got Chief Lutz is trying to let Egan know that he's got it going on. He and his boy Biddle there, you know, they're in charge of everything. They got it. They don't need any of these other guys. They need their help. And, you know, Eddie Murphy basically, you know, he cuts through the alarm tape, you know, because he wasn't always a cop. He fractured an occasional lar too when he was a kid. So he finds out, you know, basically puts a couple things together, and they realize that the C and D robbery is the city depository. So they show up to the city depository. Remember, they ask, they tell the guy, hey, sign your alarm, you're having a robbery. And the guy says, I need authorization.
And Reinhold and Murphy look at each other, draw their weapons, and do what?
Scream authorized as they shoot, as the, they
shoot
the alarm.
Right, so the alarm
and
will go
Eddie
off.
Murphy tells Judge Reinhold, hey, go get some wheels. We're going to have to go chase this armored car that's coming at me that I'm shooting for no reason because it's an armored truck. And Judge Reinhold gets the big yellow cement truck. And essentially takes out half the Beverly Hills police force as they're chasing the armored car, and they end up basically following it. They find the pickup vehicle, and they follow it to the Playboy Mansion.
Okay, so I love
where the valet is. Who do you know?
Oh, I'm gonna get. We'll get to the valet in a minute. But first of all, okay. On the cement truck, they are playing a song, and I'm big on the soundtrack from Beverly Hills Cop 2. Do you remember the song that they are playing as Judge Reinhold is running over all the different cars, trying to figure out how to drive a cement truck, and then eventually all the different squad cars smash into each other? Do you remember the song that they're playing?
I believe that Sisters? One Be There by the Pointer Sisters.
I think, wasn't it the Neutron Dance, or am I wrong? And do
Neutron
I have my
Neutron Dance was the original one when they were crashing into all the cars in the cigarette bust.
Okay, so that's the first one. So
right.
Be There is the sequel.
Yeah, as part of our, you know, basically essentially remaking it for the sequel, they had a scene with a bunch of cars getting destroyed and the Pointer Sisters song.
Okay, and I have to make a confession here. I've made confessions on different ones of we've seen that in the past about buying different things, paraphernalia, different stuff from the movies. I still have this, Famous Jay. I have the soundtrack on cassette from Beverly Hills Cop 2 that includes Be There from the Pointer Sisters, that includes George Michael, I Want Your Sex, that includes Hold On from Corey Hart that's in it, a very popular song in the 80s that was part of this soundtrack. And, of course, we'll get to Shakedown with Bob Seger. That's in the trailer that we've already played, and we'll talk about that song a little bit more in a bit. But, yeah, I would listen to these songs all the time in the car going to and from high school. I'm a little older than you, on the cassette, with the cassette player in the car. From Beverly Hills Cop 2. I would never try to reenact Be There while driving the cement truck like Judge Reinhold. I do know this, and this is the truth. You have no way of knowing this. As we talk about, we've seen that in Beverly Hills Cop 2 here. The other night, my wife and I were running an errand together where we're both driving our cars. And now with the technology being what it is, we're able to talk to each other through Bluetooth. And she's actually trying to find a parking space because we're dropping one car off and I'm picking her up. I kid you not, because remember the line in the movie when Judge Reinhold, when Rosewood is running over everything, that Foley looks at him and says, are you driving with your eyes open, or are you what? What does he say?
Using the force.
Using the force. I kid you not, the other night, I said to my wife of 22 years now, I said to her, are you looking for this parking space with your eyes open, or are you using the force? I quoted Beverly Hills Cop 2 on her.
Subconsciously, or did
yeah,
you?
I don't know why. I just, in the deep recesses of my brain, when the occasion calls for it, I bring up movie lines like this. So I did while she was trying to find the parking space. I just wondered if she was using the force or if she was actually looking as we went up and down about 8 different rows in this parking garage trying to find a parking space. So,
well, don't forget, he also asked him, do the brakes work? And he said, I don't know, I hadn't tried it yet.
Where's the seatbelt? So they do pull up at the Hefner Mansion. And, yeah, I know who's standing there because Eddie Murphy was famous for giving comedians their 15 seconds in these different movies, and he gave Chris Rock his big on-screen
his
big
first
break.
Movie role.
Right. And so you remember Chris Rock walks up to him and goes, wait, 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 wait. What is it? I get $10. What is it? I get $10 for cars.
$20 for a limo.
$20 for a limo. What the F is this thing?
Eddie Murphy had found that $50 bill when he found the truck from the robbery, and basically says, here's $50, park me next to a limo.
Put it next to a limo. Yeah, park it next to a limo. Well, we remember back in Beverly Hills Cop, the scene with where he's getting the banana. You're not going to fall for the banana on the tailpipe. He's getting the bananas at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, He's getting the bananas from Damon Wayans, another fellow comedian, and giving him his break on screen. You just go ahead and take those bananas. Just take them. He just gives him the bananas. So he was, and also you're a big fan of Gilbert Gottfried, which we'll talk about here, as Sidney Bernstein, the lawyer for Dent, right? One of Dent's lawyers at Beverly Hills. He's Dent's accountant, right? His legal advisor.
Right, let's go to the part at the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously Hugh Hefner makes an appearance in this. And according to my little research and a couple spots I found, this was the first movie that they actually allowed filmed on site at the Playboy Mansion. And Hugh Hefner did have his role because Eddie Murphy was essentially harassing Thomopolis and Carla Fry and Maxwell Dent. So the security came over and asked for their invitations. Maxwell Dent said, "This man's annoying me." He says, "I haven't begun to annoy you yet." and then Hugh Hefner walks up and he says, he like gets so excited like a kid at Christmas. He introduces himself. He says, "Yeah, any idea how many times I hung your magazine up?"
Uh-huh.
And as we record this, Hugh Hefner just passed away, 3 weeks ago?
Yep, at 90 years of age. But Hefner, 30 years ago, is right there with the Playboy Mansion. And so, yeah, they come in. Into the Playboy Mansion as allegedly Axel Foley being the pool cleaner. And those guys are from the Board of Health, the cops. That's how they talk their way in, and they eventually get to meet Hugh Hefner and crash the party and find out that the robbers are there and find out that it's Dent and Fry and Thomopolis and who they are and find them together.
Yeah, and he pickpockets him. You remember he gives him a hug, basically, and says, you know, thanks for your contribution, but they don't want you here. You know, take yourself home, whatever, right? And basically, when he does that, he pickpockets him, and so they're back in the car, they're leaving, and that's how he finds the card of Sidney Bernstein. Because he says, you know, a fractured occasional law or two as a kid.
Yeah.
So that's how he's so familiar with the ways of pickpocketing from his days as a Detroit youth.
And so he finds Sidney Bernstein, who is Gilbert Gottfried, who again was a big 1980s comedian, not yet really discovered, not known nationally, and so he gives him that chance to appear in the movie as well as Sidney Bernstein sitting in his office. They're going to come in and find out information about Dent through Sidney Bernstein's computer. And I love Gilbert Gottfried he's on the phone and they barge right in. Oh, don't let the fact that my door is closed dissuade you from any way in coming into my office. So yes, come right in. And, then, of course,
apparently he's on the phone with his wife, too.
Right.
Because he just puts her on hold without saying anything.
And then of course, they're going back and forth about the parking tickets that he allegedly has. And so that's
what Eddie Murphy wrote on the way there.
And so that's why Rosewood and Taggart put their glasses on, their sunglasses on, as Gottfried tries to bribe him out of the parking tickets. What can I put in this hand so that you forget what is in this hand? What can I give to you in this hand where you say, I don't even remember what I had in that hand there?
So say I have $200 in this hand?
So he ends up finding out, and that's what's going to lead to the big climactic scene, right, in the plot on where, after Imperium Fields, the big arms deal is going to go down and how they're going to bust Dent and Thomopolis and all the bad guys and catch them with all of the arms, the millions of dollars worth of weapons, guns and rocket launchers and grenades and everything that they have at their disposal. They're finding that out through, again, rogue police work, not by the book police work to go and detective work to go and find out what the truth is and where the true crime is, because Murphy's not buying when the racetrack hit happens. He's not buying the whole, Kane is the alphabet bomber. If Kane's the bomber, where's the money? Where's
the guns?
Well, the
code was way too easy to figure out. Remember, the first handful were very difficult, and this one basically said, in lack of a better way to put it, said, screw you, pig, sign Carlos. Carlos is Spanish for Charles. Charles Kane. You know, and so he just thought it was way too easy, because he even says that to the guys in the car. He's like, the other ones were difficult. You had to basically run numbers and be a crook to figure them out. This one anybody can figure out. And let's not forget that they had the help of Jan, who was Bogomil's daughter, who used her connections at the insurance company to realize that Bogomil was in financial – sorry, not Bogomil, Dent was in financial difficulties and let all of his policies
except
on the racetrack.
They wrote a daughter in, because we don't know anything about Jan Bogomil, but Alice Adair, the actress, is suddenly written in. Because, again, as you pointed out, that's who Eddie Murphy calls at the beginning of the movie. To find out about Bogomil's condition. We didn't know she had a daughter. And then, of course, he comes to the house to find out what's going on and what Bogomil knows. And Jan comes home from the house and almost shoots him. So they introduced her, and she becomes a key part of this because she helps them find out what Dent is up to, that Dent's going to make the arms deal and be gone with the arms and take off.
I kind of wonder, too, maybe in the original story, if she might have had a little bigger of a part, because, you know, the original Beverly Hills Cop, Lisa Albacher playing Axel Foley's buddy at the art gallery, she was kind of his partner, kind of and ran around with him when he was doing all of his investigations. Where in this one, he has Taggart and Rosewood. They kind of run around with him when he's going to all this stuff. So I do kind of wonder if she might have had a bigger part originally. But, you know, a lot of this movie was ad-libbed. You can tell because a lot of it is basically in Eddie Murphy's voice. And it's one of those things, too, where it's an hour and 40 minutes, so it's the perfect time, you know, for this kind of movie. To say it had a running time of 2 hours or so, there might have been a little more character development for Miss Jan Bogomil.
Yeah, I like that. All right, so the big climactic scene happens, big confrontations, guns being shot every which direction. Of course, Axel ends up bringing down the arms deal. Then there's a shootout with the bad guys. Axel ends up, after almost getting run over by Maxwell Dent, shooting and killing Dent, the bad guy, Jürgen Prochnow. They ends up shooting him, but then he's knocked over by the car. Dent's going to run him over with the car. He's knocked over by the car and wounded, and it looks like Carla Fry is going to blow Dent away, just like she basically blew Bogomil away and has blown other people away. And who saves Axel?
Well, you know, the way I think probably everybody, when they've watched this, the way it's set up with Billy's love of guns and everything, used to assume to be him, but it's none other than Taggart.
And so Taggart ends up, much like at the end of the first one, being the guy that saves Foley. It was Bogomil, the captain, the lieutenant at that time, the captain. Now, in this case, Taggart ends up saving him, blows her away, and of course has the great line, the great one-liner women. From the 80s movies, right? Women.
Women. Well, you know, in most of the movie, it kind of gone back and forth with Taggart. His wife has left him, and then she moved back because her mom didn't have cable TV. So, you know, he'd been having his problems with his wife anyway, so it kind of fit his character for that movie.
Did it seem like to you a little bit, as we talk about wrapping up Beverly Hills Cop 2, and then we're going to have some fun trivia here in a second, did it seem like to you that they rushed the end of the movie, like they were just trying to end it as quickly as they possibly could with the climactic scene and tie up all the loose ends? It does seem, I mean, I've seen the movie dozens of times. I saw the movie in the theater. I've seen the movie dozens and dozens of times. It does seem like it's a little rushed. Like, we got to finish this. Maybe they had an edict. At that time, studios would have an edict that this has to have a runtime of under 130 minutes or under 115 minutes or an hour 30, an hour 40 is the max. Got to stay under 145. Maybe they did rush it a little.
It's possible, because you know that obviously Simpson and Bruckheimer made this, and, you know, it's obvious that it was made to go to the bank because the first one did so well, and they didn't bother to really to write an original story. They kind of took an old Agatha Christie plot, the ABC murders, and just kind of, you know, wormed that into the original Beverly Hills Cop plot. So, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I thought the movie was really entertaining, and I thought it had kind of a cool little ending the way it just kind of wrapped everything up. And I guess they probably could have gone a little longer, but I mean, it definitely followed the formula to a T of the first one, with Mayor Ted Egan calling Inspector Todd to thank him for letting Axel come out and every, you know, I mean, they got the playbook and they followed it.
They did. I love how Jeffrey tricks him into leaving the office so that he can be there to take the call from Chief Lutz. They trick him to go have breakfast with a reporter from the handgun bulletin or whatever it is.
And then Mario Andretti Freeman wrecks the Ferrari.
Wrecks the Ferrari and the whole of the undercover. Oh, man. All right, so let me ask you some of the nuggets. Yeah.
Let me ask you this real quick. Do you think that after seeing Beverly Hills Cop 2, Eddie Murphy would have just moved out to Los Angeles and worked for the new chief of police, Bogomil, since he's buddies with all them anyways, and his inspector hates him in Detroit?
But he's always Detroit through and through. I mean, I don't
true,
think so.
He
no.
does wear his Detroit Lions jacket all throughout his time in Beverly Hills.
Well, yeah, so that's, but I don't, for the character, he has to be in Detroit, who's only coming out there to kind of be the Cape Crusader and help solve the crime, and that's it. It loses some of the punch if he comes out there to be a crime fighter. Plus, how many big crimes can they have in Beverly Hills? And he's obviously solved the two biggest ones.
Apparently so, and they obviously needed his help.
They took down Victor Maitland and now took down Dent and the arms dealer. Thermopolis, so he saw both of those crimes. All right, so let's go over some trivia and fun facts. Again, we realize Google now exists, and you can find out these different things, but you and I do not rehearse this. We say that all the time on We've Seen That. I'm TJ. He's the famous Jay. We love going back and forth about movies from the 80s and the 90s. So give me a couple fun factoids that you have. I'll hit you with a couple. We can alternate. You go first.
Here's a fun one. You mentioned Gilbert Gottfried earlier and how much we enjoy him, and I've seen that he and Eddie Murphy completely improvised the dialogue after Eddie Murphy shows up with all the parking violations. None of that was written. Apart from him picking up the phone and yelling at his wife, and then the part to him bribing the police officer and, you know, to Eddie Murphy basically saying, obviously my contact wouldn't want to be known. Oh, of course.
It's kind of a James Bond thing. You just
exactly. That is all. That was all improvised.
I don't doubt that whatsoever. How about this? The top song from the movie, Shakedown. And we're playing a little Shakedown. I like this now. Bob Seger, Shakedown. That ended up being the number one song on the Billboard 100. This song ended up being nominated for Best Song by the Academy Awards for Best Song for that 1987 year. That's a fairly famous song there with Bob Seger and Shakedown.
It's funny, people love Bob Seger, but I always think of Roll Me Away. So, you know, some of his other classics, Against the Wind. For whatever reason, I don't ever think of Shakedown. And Bob Seger, I think of Shakedown and Beverly Hills Cop, too.
And how about the music written by Harold Faltmeyer for the song Shakedown that he performed? They released it as part of the soundtrack. It ends up being the number one song for 4 weeks on the top of the Billboard Top 100 charts. It was nominated for Best Original Song and the Golden Globe Award for Best Original Song, and lost out to both to I've Had the Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing. So, but it was still nominated. It was still a famous song. Glenn Frey, who had sang The Heat Is On from the first one, from the first Beverly Hills Cop, was originally the choice to do Shakedown. But Frey didn't like the lyrics and wasn't available to sing the song. So they gave the song to Seger, and the rest is history. Seger sings a song that goes to number one and still resonates to this day. And now I'm going to give you some savant trivia about that song. Because you're a big NBA fan. You're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area with the Mavericks. I'm a big NBA fan, even though there's not an NBA team in my market in Tampa, St. Pete, Clearwater. I was a humongous Boston Celtic fan back in the 80s. And the Celtics and the Lakers, I mean, those ESPN 30 for 30s with the Celtics and the Lakers, the old school rivalry basketball that saved the NBA. Jay, those are phenomenal. Would you not agree to go back and watch those?
A little Magic and Larry Bird. I've seen some great 30 for 30s on them.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Well, I've got a great bit of trivia because I remember as a high schooler idolizing Larry Bird's three-point shooting. And so they brought into the slam dunk contest on the All-Star Weekend in February back in 1986, 86, 87, 88. They brought the three-point shootout into play. And Larry Bird very famously won the three-point shootout while you were a teenager in Dallas at the old Reunion Arena shooting three-pointers. He successfully defended the three-point shootout title in Seattle the next year in the February 1987 All-Star Game. Well, then in 1988, February of 88, is the NBA All-Star Weekend in Chicago, where eventually the Eastern Conference All-Stars won with Michael Jordan as the MVP. The three-point shootout held in Chicago. Jordan, by the way, beat Dominique Wilkins in the controversial slam dunk contest that year. But for the three-point shootout, Famous Jay, I recorded this on VHS. It's probably still available if we looked it up on YouTube. Every player shot three-point shots in basketball to the music of da-da-da-da. Do you know? Have you figured it out yet? What song they were playing? Shakedown from Bob Seger is playing in the background while Bird is reining in three-pointers and winning a third straight three-point shootout at the NBA All-Star Weekend. In fact, Bird puts his crooked number one finger in the air while he's shooting the last three-pointer while they're playing the final notes of Shakedown from Bob Seger as the instrumental music. I had that at VHS at some point for years and probably watched it 50 times. Because remember now, folks, because we would do this all the time and we've seen that, there is no YouTube. There is no way to go back and see this stuff back in the 80s, you had to have a VHS tape of it. There's no DVR. There's none of that. So I had a VHS tape that I probably watched 50 times of Larry Bird bombing in three-pointers, old Chicago Stadium, All-Star Weekend with Bob Seger's Shakedown from Beverly Hills Cop 2, the soundtrack that I have on cassette that I'm playing in the car. And I would even go outside and shoot hoops sometimes and pretend, you know, and play Shakedown on the boombox. And pretend that I'm Larry Bird. That's how famous that song is. So there's a good trivia nugget. Any other trivia nuggets that you have for Beverly Hills Cop 2?
Yeah, let me go back. With the very beginning, we were talking about the original Beverly Hills Cop was the number one movie of 1984. Beverly Hills Cop 2 grossed $153 million in America, $299 million worldwide. It was the number three box office movie in America for 1987. Do you know the two movies that finished ahead of it?
1987. You know, it's pre-Die Hard, as you mentioned. Give me one hint. Predator would have been around there with Schwarzenegger, right? That year or
Predator somewhere. Was number 12 that year.
Wow. All right, so I got that one.
The number one movie is a comedy.
I don't know.
The number one movie, I'll even give you a further hint. It was directed by Leonard Nimoy.
It's got to be one of the Star Treks then.
No.
I'm stymied.
Stars Steve Guttenberg.
I'm still stuck. Is it Cocoon?
Ted Danson.
Ah!
And Tom Selleck.
That 3 Minute and a Baby was directed by Leonard Nimoy, by Mr. Spock?
You are correct, sir. It was number one. God. It grossed $167 million. Number two was from the same studio that released Beverly Hills Cop 2, from Paramount Pictures. And it was one of the movies that scared the hell out of every man in America.
Wouldn't it be Fatal Attraction?
It was Fatal Attraction.
Right. Michael Douglas. Glenn Close. Right. All right. So those were 1, 2, and then Beverly Hills Cop 2 was the third.
Correct. And then right behind Beverly Hills Cop, I'll round out the top 10. We had Good Morning Vietnam, Moonstruck, The Untouchables, The Secret of My Success, Stakeout, Lethal Weapon, and number 10 was The Witches of Eastwick, starring Jack Nicholson.
All right, so Lethal Weapon.
It's little fun times on. We've seen that with the box office.
All right, so and again, these are movies where you didn't have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to make them because they only spent $20 million to make this. It had some action scenes, but it's not like it was a sci-fi with all the present day, you know, animation and hundreds of millions of dollars of special effects and different things that you have to do. And it ends up making a ton of money. All right, so what else? Any other nuggets that we need to know for the fans? Again, a lot of you can Google these, but I love going back and forth on we've seen that about this.
Let me see if I can come up with something kind of fun for the fans that are listening. The part when he's at the – go ahead.
I don't think that – again, this is not per se a trivia nugget. I don't think they ever intended to make – a third movie, because I think they closed off the storyline here that Bogomil is now going to be the chief of police. Axel's going to go back to Detroit. I think they ended there on that. And I'm looking, and I don't, now that I've gotten myself curious, they didn't open the door for a third movie. I think they just came back for a third movie because maybe Eddie Murphy and Judge Reinhold wanted the check. And they're in the third movie.
That's quite possible. You know, let's look at that for just a second. With Eddie Murphy, you know, he had such a great run. We talked about 48 Hours, Trading Places, Beverly Hills Cop, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Coming to America. And then he had he hit a little dud. He didn't do quite as well. He had Harlem Nights. He had another 48 Hours, which you and I both talk about and we like, but it's not as good as a lot of his other movies. And, you know, as far as entertainment-wise, it certainly didn't do as good at the box office. And then he had, you know, Adventures of Pluto Nash, Vampires in Brooklyn. He had some movies that were really duds. He basically turned into this kids film star, I guess, for stuff for his kids to be able to watch. We had The Nutty Professor. We had Dr. Doolittle.
Right.
Nutty Professor 2. We had Shrek, you know, all of those. We had Daddy Daycare, you know, Shrek Forever After. You know, he actually kind of went back to being Eddie Murphy for like one movie. Back in 2011, we had Tower Heist. You know, he got nominated for an Oscar in 2006 for Dreamgirls. You know, so, I mean, Eddie Murphy's career kind of changed after this little run here, you know, with Golden Child, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Eddie Murphy Raw, Coming to America, the ones that we knew when Eddie Murphy was like the coolest guy in the world and the biggest movie star in the world. And then next thing we know, we have The Distinguished Gentleman, you know,
yes.
And we have Boomerang and Vampires in Brooklyn. So, okay, and back to Beverly Hills Cop 3 for just a second. You know, we kind of mentioned that it was 7 years after Beverly Hills Cop 2. It looks like they kind of tried to visit the well one time's too many. It opened on Memorial Day weekend in 1994, and there was no Tagger. There was no Bogomil. You know, Billy was there, but Billy's partner was Hector Elizondo, who most of us know is the hotel manager from Pretty Woman.
Right.
And he was in it, and Inspector Todd gets killed at the beginning, and he traces it back to Wonderworld Amusement Park. And that song, Wonderworld, if you watch this movie, that horrible song will be stuck in your head for probably a week. And basically, the story has nothing to do with the other two. And this one,
that's what I mean.
The director of security at Wonderworld is like is making fake money with printers. It's just not a very good movie. In fact, I saw there's a quote where Eddie Murphy was, they're talking about potentially making a Beverly Hills Cop 4 and acting like Beverly Hills Cop 3 never existed. And Eddie Murphy basically said Beverly Hills Cop 3 was garbage.
It was garbage.
I go all over the world and I get recognized for people for the movies, but nobody he's ever met likes that movie.
Yeah, well, and that only lends credence to what I was saying before. They had closed off the story, and it's almost like they didn't know what to do with the third movie to try to bring it back. And I got to confess to you, I've never seen Beverly Hills Cop 3 all the way through. I've seen a couple parts of it. I've never watched it. I heard the bad reviews. I never got into it. So I want to leave 2 the way it is. I don't want to watch 3 and be totally turned off by it. So 30 years later, at the time that we're doing this, we've seen that. I've never seen that movie all the way through. I can't tell you the plot line of it. I can't even tell you how it ends, Famous Jay. How about that?
You didn't miss much. I'll leave it at that. I really enjoy the first one. I really enjoy the second one. The second one is one of those, it's kind of like, it comes on all the time, obviously. It's on Stars basically in rotation right now. If anybody wants to watch it, they can pop on Stars on Demand and watch it in a matter of seconds. But definitely part 3 I would not recommend unless you are really bored.
All right, so did we cover everything that we needed to cover here on this edition of We've Seen That? What else do we need to tell the audience about this movie on and our takes
on? One last thing I did want to mention is we mentioned Tony Scott, the director, earlier. He did pass away a couple years back. Don Simpson, one of the producers of this from Simpson and Bruckheimer fame, he passed away. So if they do make a Beverly Hills Cop 4, which apparently is in development, you know, they're obviously talk about Simpson and Bruckheimer and Tony Scott. They also made Top Gun, and there's talk of a Top Gun sequel called Top Gun Maverick coming
out.
Yeah,
but they've been talking about that for years and have never made it.
Yeah, but same thing with Beverly Hills Cop 4, you know, with Bruckheimer, you know, he's made more than enough money he'll ever need from the Pirates of the Caribbean and the CSI series. Of course, he did lose a little bit on the Lone Ranger. Either way, I'm kind of curious to see if that happens. There was talk a couple of years ago. In fact, they even filmed a pilot for a Beverly Hills Cop TV show with Brandon T. Jackson would have been in it. And I think Eddie Murphy would have been a guest star in the pilot, but he was not going to be on the show. But that did not get picked up. So that's kind of where we're at in Beverly Hills Cop.
If I'm correct, though, didn't John Ashton get cast in kind of a California comedy as a cop? With a partner, and it was a Beverly Hills themed NBC show, like in the 90s, off of Beverly Hills Cop 2. They tried to make
called.
And it never worked.
Right?
It never worked.
You know, John Ashton was great in Midnight Run,
right?
Which was from original Beverly Hills Cop director Martin Brest.
Yes, so that never worked. They tried different offshoots. For my money, leave it alone. For my opinion, leave it alone. Don't make a fourth one. The third one was a mistake. Should have never been made. Leave it alone. Leave Beverly Hills Cop and Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Do it right. Pretend like part three never existed. None of that happened. Wonderworld song did not happen. Uncle Dave, none of that. Pick it up where the second one left off.
You're trying to unlearn all of that stuff.
I don't think Ronnie Cox and John Ashton would be too busy to reprise their roles now.
No.
Just saying.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. And everybody would now be elderly, basically. Maybe Beverly Hills Cop 4 is at the retirement home. Anyway,
maybe they could be in your hometown of Tampa.
That's true. We do have a lot of retirees, especially in the wintertime, that come in and around here. I think we've covered it all. I hear the music in the background. Did you have fun on this edition of We've Seen That?
Good times talking Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Again, this movie out 30 years ago at the time that we're talking. That's hard to believe. I do have the cassette. I do have
thing,
the audio cassette of the soundtrack.
Anybody wants to talk about Beverly Hills Cop 2 or anything else, feel free to contact me on Twitter at TheFamousJay.
Yes, and by the same token, you can find We've Seen That on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter at BuckSidelineGuy. We'll be tweeting about this. You can sound off about our opinions, our different things about it. We would love to hear your feedback. Also, you can feedback through our friends at Blog Talk. Talk Radio that house these podcasts. So love to hear some feedback on what we had to say on this. I'm glad you had fun.
Thanks a lot, TJ. Look forward to next time.
There is the famous Jay Betzel. I'm TJ Reeves. Again, follow him on Twitter at the famous Jay. Follow me on Twitter at Buck Sideline Guy. The name of this show is We've Seen That. We'll be back again, not too far down the road. We always love talking about movies of the 80s, 90s, and more on We've Seen That. That's this edition about Beverly Hills Cop 2. Bye.